Hello and welcome to Beyond Reproach. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year. New Year, new me.
New you.
Newer me.
New us. New show. Who dis?
Yes.
This is Tux Lursel.
This is Stephanie Domingo.
We come to you from Bushwick, Brooklyn, where we record on land belonging to the Lenape Nation, a nation that is one of many still very much out here doing its thing, and we would like to acknowledge that.
Yes.
This is Beyond Reproach. This is the show about scandals and scandalousness in American politics and government.
Sure enough.
We be drinking and we be swearing and we be fucking shit up.
Yep.
Today we are drinking a cocktail that was very popular in the 1990s, though it came earlier, but it was very big
in the classic
1990s. It feels very masculine.
Yeah.
It feels very daytime.
Mm-hmm.
We are drinking a Bloody Mary.
I love it. It's so pretty. I love all of the like decorations.
Mm-hmm. Accoutrement.
The accoutrement. I like that there's a cornichon.
Mm-hmm. A cornichon. When I was Googling like how to make one, everybody has their own recipe and every recipe is different.
Mm-hmm.
And the garnish in every single recipe was different. But essentially, I discovered that you can garnish it. I mean, obviously, it has to have the celery stick.
Yeah, obviously.
But anything else, like people, there, if you look pictures of Bloody Marys,
I've seen carrots.
People garnish them with sliders, like mini hamburgers. People garnish them with fried chicken.
What?
Yes. People are taking, like, not like a little cocktail skewer, but like a full, like a big grilling skewer and doing like pickles. Like you get
all this in a glass, though.
It's like sticking out, like it's the garnish is bigger than
so
the
it's
glass.
Like a meal.
Yeah,
they're just having a meal. There's like just chicken wings and sliders.
Yeah, totally.
And,
yeah,
like, what?
Yeah,
I didn't know people were doing all of that, but this is America.
Yeah,
so this feels very
this
American.
This is America. Yeah, personally, I like in a Bloody Mary, I like an olive, like a green olive is great, a cornichon is great,
yes.
Cocktail onions are nice.
Mm-hmm. I like anything pickled.
Pickled green beans, especially. Yeah. Pickled asparagus.
Yeah, pickled carrots. Mm-hmm. I love.
So let's dive into this here cocktail history. So as vodka was becoming more and more popular nationwide in the 1970s, pre-made Bloody Mary mixes started showing up on grocery store shelves, which help spread this cocktail to basically every corner of the country.
Mm-hmm.
Anyone knew, basically like after the 70s or 80s, everyone knew what a Bloody Mary was, even if they hadn't had one. By the 1990s, it was hard to imagine a time when they weren't popular everywhere, just sort of ubiquitous and popular in every different walk of life. Businessmen in expensive suits were drinking Bloody Marys in like fancy restaurants,
yeah,
for lunch meetings. At the same time that like 20-somethings were drinking bottomless brunches. You know
yeah.
what I mean?
They remind me of airplanes.
Totally.
I see a lot of people drinking them in the morning.
Yeah.
On planes.
Yeah. I always feel like, especially if you're like flying and you get on a flight that gives you free booze, I always feel like I want to drink it like 10 o'clock in the morning, but I never know what to drink because I'm not going to drink like whiskey at 10 a.m.
Yeah.
So Bloody Mary is the answer. I never thought about that.
It is the answer.
Yeah.
Yeah. I've seen my mom order them in the morning on a
That's
plane.
That's funny. The weird thing is, even though they were invented in the 20th century, the Bloody Mary has one of the haziest histories of any cocktail I've tried to research.
How strange.
There are so many different possible origin stories and like different possibilities of where the name came from
oh.
or who came up with it originally.
Wow.
Where it was invented. Yeah. If you're on the Googles, the most common origin story that you're going to find is that they were invented by a bartender named Ferdinand Petiot in the early 1920s at the famed Harry's New York Bar in Paris. Legend has it that Petiot invented the Bloody Mary because there were a bunch of Russians that were moving to Paris in the 1920s because they were fleeing the Russian Revolution, and they had a taste for vodka, which wasn't super common in Paris yet.
Yeah.
Petiot found it flavorless, so he added tomato juice and some spices to kind of jazz it up a little bit.
Interesting. I love it.
Yeah. Some stories say that the name that he gave it came from the British Queen Mary, who the Protestants called Bloody Mary.
Yeah.
Other stories say that the name is referenced to a famous cocktail bar in Chicago that used to was called the Bucket of Blood. Okay. I guess it had some kind of gangster element to it. I don't really know. I didn't look any further because this is a long story anyways. But either way, after Prohibition, Petillo moved from France to the United States, and he brought the Bloody Mary with him to Manhattan, where he worked at the King Cole Bar in the St. Regis Hotel. For some reason, the management made him change the name from the Bloody Mary to the Red Snapper.
Oh.
So they were called the Red Snapper for a while.
Okay.
I guess the King Cole Bar has reopened, and you can go there now, today, and get a Red Snapper at the King Cole Bar.
Wow, they still call it that.
Yeah.
Okay.
But the name didn't really stick anywhere else. And as the popularity spread, everyone else was calling it a Bloody Mary.
Yeah.
In the 40s, Petillo started adding even more ingredients to it to kind of spice it up a little bit. Hot sauce became a common ingredient. Horseradish, lemon juice, and celery salt became sort of standard issue for a Bloody Mary. His jazzed up, spicier version really caught on, and over the years it became a global sensation. Fun fact, Ferdinand Petillo retired from the St. Regis Hotel in 1966, and he moved to Canton, Ohio.
What?
Yes.
That's crazy.
He used to...
he lived in Paris, then he lived in New York, and now he's in Canton, Ohio?
Well, he's dead now, but yeah.
That's so bizarre. I love that. I don't understand it.
He used to do sort of like guest bartending spots at some restaurant in Ohio, but I looked it up, but it's not around anymore. Oh, so I was going to ask you if you'd ever eaten there, but
that's so funny. My scandal intersects Canton, Ohio as well.
Oh, that's so funny.
Yeah.
But so yeah, while this story about Petillo is one of the most common stories that you're going to find on the internet, that doesn't actually mean that it's true. Oh. At least not the whole thing.
There's Snopes for it?
not a Snopes, but I did find that a cocktail historian named Jack McGarry did a deep dive on the origins of the Bloody Mary and found out that it was most likely actually invented by an early Hollywood comedian named George Jessel. In his autobiography, Jessel said that he invented this cocktail in 1927 at a hotel in Palm Beach, Florida.
Okay.
He said that he and a buddy were trying to come up with a hangover cure when the bartender at the hotel reached behind the bar. This is a quote from his book. "Here, Georgie, try this," he said, holding up a dusty bottle I had never seen before it. "They call it vodka. We've had it for 6 years and nobody has ever asked for it." I looked at it, sniffed it. It was pretty pungent. "Hell, what have I got to lose? Get me some Worcestershire sauce, some tomato juice, and lemon. That ought to kill the smell."
Oh, okay.
Jessel was really a big fan of that tomato juice cocktail that I mentioned before.
Mm-hmm.
So he mixed this vodka with his tomato juice cocktail, added some spices, and he was tasting it. He and his buddy were really liking the taste when a socialite.
Okay, I'm just like, okay, go on, no. Socialist.
A socialite, not socialist, distinctly different from a socialist, named Mary Brown Warburton walked in. "Here, Mary, take a taste of this and see what you think." Just as she did, she spilled some down the front of her white evening gown, took one look at the mess and laughed. "Now you can call me Bloody Mary, George."
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Honestly, to me, Petillo's story sounds more believable, at least on paper. But McGarry points out that if the Bloody Mary had been created in Paris in the 1920s, that it would have been featured in at least one of the many cocktail books that were coming out about cocktail culture in Paris in the 20s and 30s.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't.
Oh, okay.
So... especially Harry's New York Bar was like really super famous, like total celebrity haunt.
Yeah.
So it would be really weird.
Yeah, I was kind of surprised. Paris.
Yeah.
It seems so American.
I know. Yeah. Petillo gave an interview to the New Yorker in 1964 in which he seemingly admits that Jessel's version came first. He said, "I initiated the Bloody Mary of today. Jessel said he created it, but it was nothing but vodka and tomato juice when I took it over."
Okay.
So he's saying like...
I upgraded it. Yeah. I made it something new.
Which is legit because it's always been evolving. Like I said, every recipe is different.
Mm-hmm.
One bartender called it the meatloaf of the cocktail world.
That is funny.
Yeah.
Ew, but that's funny. Yeah.
So it seems like the most accurate version of this story is that Jessel created this very simple version in Florida, but it didn't really become the cocktail we know today until Petillo moved from Paris to New York City and started making it at the St. Regis Hotel, started tweaking it, adding new flavors and spices. So that's how we got it. As for the celery stick garnish, Jessel and Petillo have nothing to do with that. That most likely came from a restaurant in Chicago called the Pump Room in the 50s or 60s. But the celery stick garnish didn't appear in print in a recipe for a Bloody Mary until 1979. The only other thing I want to mention here is that horseradish somehow is a seemingly controversial ingredient.
How?
Most of my research says that Petillo did use horseradish, at least at some point in his sort of experiments and tweaking. But a lot of Bloody Mary purists will not use horseradish and don't like it in a Bloody Mary. But I feel like...
it needs it.
It needs it.
Yeah, and I need that spice. I need that heat.
Yeah, totally. There was hot sauce, but like, it's not enough.
It's not the same kind of heat.
But either way, even if it's not exactly historically accurate, by the 90s, the era of your story today, everyone put horseradish in a Bloody Mary. So it's historically accurate for the 1990s for sure. So yeah, that's the Bloody Mary.
I love it.
Before we take our little taste.
I keep looking at it.
Yeah, I know.
Longingly.
Before we take our taste, I just want to say that we have recently added some new tiers to our Patreon page.
Very exciting stuff, you
and,
guys.
And some of our different tiers include the benefit of getting a shout out
during our cocktails segment. Yes,
so we just want to say thank you, thank you, thank you to some of our favorite people in the world.
We have Brenda Lurzel.
Yeah.
We love her.
We sure do.
We have Annie Witzel. Love her. She's from my hometown.
Mm-hmm. We talk to her all the time.
All the time. Oh my God.
Like she found
Not only is she from my hometown, we lived like two blocks away at one point.
So wild.
For like 3 years, we lived two blocks away.
But you didn't know each other. She found you.
We went
you
to different schools.
The podcast.
Through the podcast. Yeah.
That's so wild.
So weird. So amazing though. So we have Krista Sigmund. We have George Donahue, who's a friend of yours. Mm-hmm. We have Nicole Daniel. We have Maria Milazzo.
Friend of the podcast from the...
Peculiar Picture Show. Yeah, love it. Love the show. Love the both of them. We have Victoria Bacchetti. New Victoria Bacchetti. She's new on our list. We don't know her as well yet.
Yet.
We're getting to know her. And last but not least, we have Elise Catalanotte. It's very Italian. I love it. So thank you, all of these Patreon supporters. You don't know how much you mean to us.
Yes.
Like, it's a big deal. I was telling Tux earlier that we often feel like we're talking to ourselves. So to have people who are actually supporting the podcast feels really nice.
Absolutely.
And if you're not a supporter and you're like, oh, I'd like to be on this list, I'd like a shout out.
Yeah. Yeah, check out
I'd love for Stephanie to butcher my name.
Check out our Patreon page, see the different tiers, and... cheers to you guys.
Yes.
Thank you so much. We're raising a glass to you.
Cheers
to you.
And
we finally get to taste our Bloody Marys.
Yes. A little cheers to cheers.
Cheers.
When I was a kid at school learning the golden rule, teacher often used to say, if you don't tell a lie, there's not a reason why you can't be like Washington someday. How could Washington be a married man and never, never tell a lie?
So good. Oh my God, I love this. It needs a horseradish. I'm sorry.
Absolutely.
I couldn't imagine this without it.
Yeah, I know. So Bloody Mary obviously is made with vodka and tomato juice. This one is also made with lemon juice, Worcestershire, hot sauce, paprika. Traditionally, it's made with celery salt. I like it a little spicier, so I use Old Bay, which has celery salt in it, black pepper, and horseradish. And ours today is garnished with a celery stick, some green olives, and a cornichon.
So good. And it definitely goes well with my scandal today. On May 19th, 1992, Vice President Dan Quayle made an infamous campaign speech titled Reflections on Urban America.
Oh my fucking God.
Do you know this story?
No.
Oh my God.
No.
Do you remember Dan Quayle?
Vaguely. So I know of him, but I was too young to really be into, I did not remember what he looked like.
So I'm just showing a picture of Dan Quayle because a guy like this, a Republican in 1992, making a speech about reflections on urban America.
What the fuck do you know about urban America, you mayonnaise ass looking motherfucker?
You know it's going to be some mess.
Oh my God.
He's from Indiana.
What urban centers are in Indiana, motherfucker?
That is a good question. I don't think they exist. I guess Gary, I don't know. So this speech which is like practically his birthright, looking like he does.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
It would end his political career.
Amazing. Good. That's what he fucking gets. Shut your wet mouth. Nobody asked you for
this. Thank you. About something you know nothing about.
Yeah.
So this would happen not because people are mad at him for taking a shit on poor people. People were fine with this. This was 1992. This is post-Reagan. Like, it's... Everyone was fine with that.
Yeah.
However, as he was wrapping up his speech, he decided that he was going to drag a popular white woman.
Oh, dear.
He came for someone who was famous, who was a investigative journalist with a platform at the height of her DC fame. Her newsroom tackled issues like gun violence, mass incarceration, sexual harassment in the workplace. They covered the Bush inauguration in 88 and later the Anita Hill hearings. She took calls from Gaddafi back when, like, Gaddafi was our friend and Cronkite. She got maced in 1968 at the DNC.
Oh, my God.
Do you know who I'm talking about?
Cokie Robinson? Robertson? No.
No.
Ariane Huffington?
You're very close. Mm. So my scandal today is the historic fight between Vice President Dan Quayle and Murphy Brown.
Murphy Brown?
Not the real life Murphy Brown, because there is no real life Murphy Brown.
Yes.
The fictional character.
Oh my God. What?
No one asked for this, but here he was. But first a toast.
Oh my God.
Let us raise our glass.
Yes.
To waging a culture war against an imaginary woman and losing spectacularly. You love to see it.
Oh my God. I'll drink to that.
I love this story. It's so silly, but it feels like it could be pulled from the headlines because our news is mess.
Yeah.
So before I jump into this scandal, I want to talk very, very briefly about everyone's favorite culture war, family values.
Mm-hmm.
We know it. We hate it. Many claim that the fear over the like decline of the American family is the result of demographic shifts, like a rise in divorces, a rise in non-marital births or out-of-wedlock births, a rise in single-parent families, mm-hmm. households. But the issue may be more about changes in politics than changes in actual family structure.
Okay.
So the American family, like TM, doesn't really exist. Like, okay. There's never been this, like, stable, static, one-fits-all kind of
totally.
Thing at all. It seems more of a myth. You know,
yeah.
We want to aspire to be this American family that's never really exists in reality. So at the heart of this culture war is the question of responsibility. Is it the responsibility of society to take care of the family, or is it the responsibility of family to take care of society?
Hmm. Okay.
Whenever there are these like middle class anxieties about national identity, and by that I just mean white supremacy, this is when the family comes front and center. And the family is both the source of society's ills and the potential solve for society's problems. Whenever this very fragile, very violent identity appears to be threatened by immigrants, by people who are sexual minorities, like LGBTQ people, racial minorities, God forbid, feminists.
The horror.
Then here come the soldiers of, you know, family values with their tiki torches.
Oh, my God.
Out to save the country. Save the family. So family values is this, like, shape-shifting, very anti-feminist, like, just catch-all. Mm-hmm. And it's very, very class-based.
Yeah.
Like, for example, someone who is, like, a poor single mother on welfare, if she gets a job, then she has good family values. But if she stays home with her child, then she has bad family values. And someone who is, like, middle class, like, let's say a white woman goes out and gets mm-hmm. a job, she has bad family values. But if she stays home with her kids, she has good family yeah. values. It's like... It's garbage.
Yeah.
And these norms change over time. In the 1930s, I don't know if you knew this, but they welfare payments went to women so they would stay home and nurture their children.
Oh, wow.
Because they wanted kids to grow up well
yeah.
and be like well-functioning members sure. of society. Imagine that.
Ugh,
it was like
this country.
Europe. Yeah. So when did this politicized family anxiety start? Like, do you know?
I have no idea. Yeah. I just remember being a kid and hearing like teachers talk about how like The Simpsons was destroying family values and
yes.
What was that show? Married with Children.
Oh, yes. With
the Bundys. Mm-hmm. They were absolutely destroying family values.
You were watching both of those shows. Oh,
absolutely, because they were hilarious.
Yeah. Hilarious. So it all started with TR.
Ah.
Teddy Roosevelt is the one who brought the family front and center, where it has remained ever since, unfortunately. So Roosevelt, in his sixth annual message to Congress, this is in 1903.
Mm-hmm.
He warned, and this is a quote, "When home ties are loosened, when men and women cease to regard a worthy family life as the best life worth living, then evil days of the Commonwealth are at hand. There are these regions in our own land and classes of our own population where the birth rate has sunk below the death rate. Surely it should need no demonstration to show that willful sterility is, from the standpoint of the nation, the one sin for which the penalty is national death, race death. No man, no woman can shirk the primary duties of life, whether for love of ease and pleasure or for any other reason, and retain his or her self-respect."
Wow.
Tell us how you really feel,
Those
TR.
Are some words.
Right?
$5. Like, the whole thing is all $5 words.
Yes.
Wow.
So fun to read.
I bet, yeah.
So in the Progressive Era... So things have kind of just like shifted back and forth with every like new political wave. So in the Progressive Era, the responsibility for the well-being of society swung back to the state because of the stock market. Like, white middle-class people were starting to feel the suffering that was reserved for people of color, people who were poor, people, you know, disabled, et cetera, single mothers. So, you know, the state's like, no, we can't have that. We need to help them. During the Cold War, the relationship between the family and the state shifted again. The threats to national identity, they were no longer coming from white immigrants.
Okay.
Because they had, you know, been absorbed into whiteness,
sure.
You know, taken their place in the hierarchy. And wasn't really coming from Black Americans either, because at this time, most politicians were supporting, or at least paying lip service to, their civil rights against the Southern segregationists during this period. But the threat was now coming from communism.
Of course.
And from counterculture.
Mm-hmm.
And the hyper-capitalist nuclear family was the solution to all of this, to the Red Menace. So there were all these new tax breaks created for families. This is when, like, tax breaks for kids...
Okay.
We're coming online, mortgages for families. By the 60s, political sentiment shifted again with Lyndon Johnson's Great Society.
Yes.
You know, we know how well that was received when the government started to take responsibility for its Black citizens as well. And we're kind of still dealing with the aftermath of that.
Yeah.
So during the run-up to the 1992 election, culture wars were alive and well.
Good times.
Yeah. Then President George H.W. Bush was regularly attacking his rival, Bill Clinton, as the epitome of just all of the what was wrong with the 60s. Like,
okay.
He was talking about his youth, how mm-hmm. he smoked pot, how he was like a womanizer, how he dodged the draft.
Hmm. Yeah.
So in response... Clinton decides that he's going to also jump on the bandwagon of family values. He's going to bring out his Bible. He's going to use his Southern accent.
Mm-hmm.
And they just basically tried to out family values each other.
Yeah, you got to play the game. It's stupid, but...
Exactly. It is stupid, but you have to play it.
Yeah.
So enter a gaffe-prone Vice President Dan Quayle, who I thought prior to researching this story was kind of unfairly maligned in the press.
Mm-hmm.
Because I just remember all those hacky jokes from the 90s
yeah.
about, you know, how dumb he is.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not here defending this man or any man. Like, I am me. Like, I'm not built that way. It's not part of my ministry. But I will say, not everyone is smart. And that's fine.
Should you be... the second in line to be the president of the country.
Okay. I see what you're doing there. And okay. Probably not.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. You're right. I was just saying that, you know, there's no shame in being, you know, of lesser intelligence. However, what is shameful is that James Danforth Quayle, that's his name.
Oh, my.
Danforth.
Okie doke.
The product of white intergenerational wealth, obviously, with that name.
Clearly.
Only got into Indiana University's law school on an affirmative action program.
Excuse me?
He exploited a program meant to help racial minorities and those from lower socioeconomic backgrounds.
Duh.
So there's a lot of information about this. It's in his Wikipedia page. Like, the man is trash for this. So he was campaigning in Canton, Ohio. This was always coming up on the campaign trail because people were asking, like, you were in this program? Like, you, bro? Like, what? He told reporters in Canton that I got into law school fair and square.
Okay.
That's his defense. Like, bro.
In what respect, Charlie? So was he like Elizabeth Warren? Was he saying that he was?
No.
Huh.
He was just a rich white man getting into this program. It was just, you know, it was just a coincidence that his great-grandfather gave a really big donation to the school around that time. No one should look into that. Who's to say if that had any influence? Or the fact that the dean of the law school was really good friends with his dad and would later officiate his wedding a few years later.
Unrelated.
Clearly. Unrelated. Come on.
Circumstantial.
Nothing to see here but a pile of bootstraps. Okay. So yeah, he wasn't supposed to be in the program, but he was because he paid his way into it. So he graduates. He never practices law. He just goes to work for his grandparents. They were publishers. They had different newspapers in two cities. I think two newspapers in Arizona and like two in Indiana. But I think he just wanted to go into politics and wanted a law degree.
Sure.
So people wouldn't think he was stupid.
Yeah. If you're rich, it doesn't matter if you're stupid.
Like, that was first, like, front and center in my brain when I'm like, you don't have to do all this, Dan. You can just be rich. And it's fine.
I mean, clearly, look at the president. Like, look at your president. The Bush family.
Yeah.
You don't have to be, you don't have to be smart as long as you're rich.
It's like, I don't know who told you you had to do all this. You had to, like, take a spot from a black person. Like, you didn't. You didn't. You could have just worked for your family and then gone into politics. Like, people do this every day.
That's wild. I mean, I get the idea of wanting a law degree if you're going into politics anyways, though, because there's something, a lot of lawyers become politicians.
So, yeah, he worked for his family for 2 years, and then he became Indiana's representative for the 4th District in Indiana. So, let's get into it. On May 19th, 1992, a day after your 11th birthday?
9th birthday.
Yes, yeah. You're right, 9th. I can't math. I can't math well. So this isn't a re-election year. The vice president was in San Francisco to deliver a campaign speech to the Commonwealth Club of California. The LA riots happened
weeks
prior.
Yes, in 1992. Yeah.
Yep. For the purpose of this story, you just need to know that the protests began April 29th. The protests are very complicated. Tux and I, we've talked about maybe doing splitting it up because it's such a big topic. But for this scandal, you just need to know that there was a huge riot after the four cops for LAPD were acquitted for beating Rodney King on camera like the year prior.
I'm actually going to talk about this a little bit in my scandal.
Oh,
too.
Really?
That's funny. Yeah.
Oh, okay. Yeah, it's so funny that we're both doing scandals from 1992.
Yeah, my story that I'm going to tell in 2 weeks is also from 1992.
I love it. So weird. So yeah, so Dan, he starts his speech in a very odd way, but it's Dan Quayle.
Yeah.
He's a weirdo. He's known at this point already for just saying weird things, like having gaffes all the time, like misspeaking.
And yeah.
Just being generally awkward and weird. So he starts by saying, as you may know, I've just returned from a week-long trip to Japan. Dan, no one's checking for you like this. Zero people.
Nobody gives
is following
a shit about
the vice president.
Nobody cares about the vice president.
What? It's so confusing.
Dan, haven't you seen Veep? No one cares about the vice president.
He's acting like he hasn't seen Veep. Get with it. So he goes on. I was there to commemorate the 20th anniversary of the reversion of Okinawa to Japan by the United States, an act that has made a lasting impression on the Japanese. Just like,
what?
A weird flex?
Yeah.
Of course the Japanese are going to remember the fact that the U.S. colonized one of their islands for 27 years and actually held nuclear weapons on that island. Like, that wasn't traumatizing as fuck. Like, okay, Dan. This speech is very long. Whoever wrote it for him wrote way too many words. He says that when he was in Japan, the Japanese were asking about the LA riots, and he was struggling to explain it to them. They were saying, like, is it a problem because you guys are so diverse, you're so multicultural, you know, we in Japan, we are, you know, almost a monolith, like, that's why we don't have a lot of civil unrest. So this is a quote. I explain that our diversity is our strength, and I explain that immigrants who come to our shores have made and continue to make vast contributions to our culture and our economy. Nothing about Native people, nothing about enslaved people. Cool, 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 cool. It is wrong to imply that the Los Angeles riots were an inevitable outcome of our diversified society. But the question that I tried to answer in Japan is one that needs answering here. What happened? Why? And how do we prevent it in the future? One response has been predictable. Instead of denouncing wrongdoing, some have shown tolerance for rioters. Tolerance for rioters?
Oh, fucking God.
I never. How about insurrectionists, though?
Well, they weren't white, Stephanie.
I know. What a stupid thing to say. I'm sorry. So he goes on. In a nutshell, I believe the lawless social anarchy, which we saw is directly related to the breakdown of family structure, personal responsibility, and social order in too many areas of our society.
So you completely missed the fucking point.
What point?
What, like,
he can see no point from where he's standing. He went on for another like 2,000 words about just how terrible Black people are and how, you know, they need to find the bootstraps that he found to get ahead.
In his daddy's bank account.
Yeah. So he goes on, there is no question that this country has had a terrible problem with race and racism. Had, past tense.
Mm-hmm, of course.
The evil of slavery has left a long legacy, but we have faced racism squarely.
Have we? In 1992?
And we have made progress in the past quarter century. So he went on, it would be overly simplistic to blame this social breakdown on the programs of the Great Society alone, but he's about to.
Oh my God. It would be
absolutely wrong to blame it on the growth and success most Americans enjoyed during the 1980s.
Most, but not.
Success? Okay.
You fuck.
He goes on, the intergenerational poverty that troubles us so much today is predominantly a poverty of values.
Are you fucking kidding me?
It's a poverty of poverty, Dan. It's a poverty of poverty because people's po.
Yeah, they do not have money, unlike you. I know that's difficult for you to understand, but not everybody came from a fucking trust fund and bought their way into college.
Yeah.
That program that you benefited from wasn't for you. It was for people who don't have money.
Yes. He goes on. Our inner cities are filled with children having children, with people who have not been able to take advantage of educational opportunities.
Because you took their slot. Yes. Babies with having people, babies, you piece of shit.
Yeah. This is the 90s. This is so 1992. Oh, this is like we dug it up. It's a time capsule. He goes on, with people who are dependent on drugs or the narcotic of welfare.
No, not the narcotic of welfare.
Yes. This bitch fixed his face to talk about the narcotic of welfare. Some people say law and order are code words. Well, they are code words. Code words for safety, getting control of our streets, and freedom from fear.
I cannot.
So, you know, et cetera, et cetera. Black on black crime.
Oh, Jesus.
Plus another 1,000 words. But then he pivoted to Murphy Brown.
Because out of all the TV shows in 1992 that you could attack.
Yeah.
You're not going after fucking Married with Children or The Simpsons.
No. It doesn't help matters when primetime TV has Murphy Brown, a character who supposedly epitomizes today's intelligent, highly paid professional woman, mocking the importance of fathers by bearing a child alone and calling it just another lifestyle choice.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. One sentence about a fictional white woman and all hell broke loose.
After that whole speech, that's what people were upset about.
Correct.
A fictional white woman.
She's glamorizing single motherhood.
Okay. So that's why black people are poor. Because obviously, TV is glamorizing single motherhood through a fictional rich white lady.
It was one sentence in a speech that was just talking spicy and wrong about black people. But this is the one thing that the media latched onto.
I cannot.
So I think this is a good place for a little break-see.
I absolutely I feel like need you to need drink it, more cocktails right? after this. Oh my
right?
lord. We'll be right back.
So, have you ever thought about what would happen if your airline window popped out?
Or if you can build a jetpack using only machine guns?
Well, we found out you could, but you really shouldn't. Hi, I'm Jill Chacha.
And I'm Marissa Riley.
Together, we have one comedy science-y show called, well, that's interesting.
It's for folks who like to learn about weird stuff, like how hair can grow between your teeth and what happens if the moon disappears.
If you need a break from the world or need interesting stuff to bring up at a party when those happen again, come on by.
Find Well That's Interesting wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
Okay, we're back.
We're back.
Got new Bloody Marys.
Yeah, we're gonna get into this bullshit.
I guess I'm glad that I wasn't as politically aware in the 90s. Well, I was 9 years
old. You were 9 years old.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I'm glad I was I was not conscious either because what the fuck?
Oh, my God. I mean, things are horrific right now, obviously, but like the people's attitudes toward race and stuff have evolved so much in the last 30 years.
Absolutely. Fuck shit's still happening, but at least people are starting to be outraged.
Yeah.
Like, no one had any problem with any of the things he said about black people.
Totally. I don't think that conservatives have evolved very much. You're, facts. But at least there are progressives who, in politics, who really do believe the right things and are trying to make things better in a real way.
There were a lot of liberal people in the 90s. Like, I mean, the people who I'm about to talk about who were watching Murphy Brown.
Yeah.
All of them were fine with it, too.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, so the first show of, like, the premiere episode, the pilot of Murphy Brown, it came out in the fall of 1988. And it instantly became a hit. Because the creator of the show was like a woman. She had created this really strong character. It revolved around this 42-year-old divorced feminist, like badass, named Murphy Brown. She was a journalist at the top of her game, and she was fresh out of a stint at Betty Ford's clinic.
Okay.
She was a recovering alcoholic. She was previously like addicted to cigarettes as well. So she had battled her addictions. She was kind of this imperfect character, but like doing her best. And she decided that she was going to raise a child on her own.
Okay.
She had a fling with her ex-husband, and that's how she got pregnant. And he was just a piece of shit, and he didn't want to be involved. So she's like, I'll do this by myself.
How immoral of her. Destroying the fabric of America.
I know.
Single-handedly.
Yes, ruining society with her lifestyle choice.
Oh, my God.
So she was like an older, saltier, like hipper version of like Mary Tyler Moore.
Sure, yeah.
That was like the character that they was going for. The show was really quirky and quippy. There were all these references to politics that made people like in flyover states feel like they were DC insiders. Mm-hmm. So it was, you know, I get why it was popular. They also, like, the show featured a ton of black music, like lots of like Motown. There are all these like dance numbers and like lip syncing to classic black music.
Yeah.
Wow. Like, I get why it was popular because, you know, black culture is everything.
Sure. But
black people, not so much, right? So the night before this racist ass speech, 38 million viewers tuned in to watch the season 4 finale where she gave birth to her son.
Ah, okay. Yeah. So it was fresh on his mind.
Yes.
Huh.
The episode ends with her singing to her newborn son, Aretha Franklin's Natural Woman.
Wow.
In a key that I hope I never hear again. Like, it is bad. But, you know, white liberals loved her. Like, rode for her. Like, we're so upset. Like, ill word was said against her.
I love that white liberals heard that whole ass speech.
Correct.
And that's what they were upset about.
Yep. So, Quayle's speech that was called Reflections on Urban America. It was dubbed the Murphy Brown speech.
Because he said one fucking word yes. at the end of the speech.
Yes. So there is a little to be said about this. Like, this show was very, there were lots of cameos. There were tons of actors and also real journalists okay. stopping by the show.
Wow.
So there was this media kind of fixation with it.
Sure.
Because, you know, reporters and people who were actual journalists felt like, oh, there's a show about us.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So totally. I think that definitely played into just blowing this thing into this big scandal that it never yeah. should have been.
Yeah.
So, you know, the reaction was pretty swift. Later that day, President Bush was in Canada with the Canadian Prime Minister, you know, just doing president shit. And he's being asked about Murphy Brown. And he's confused. I don't think this Murphy Brown one sentence was in the speech. I think he said just, this.
I think it freestyled it.
Yeah, or, yeah. I think it was top of mind. Again, I didn't read this, but it just seemed the reaction of the president, I think, showed me that, like, why would I need to be talking about Murphy Brown? Like, my vice president said what? So he told reporters no more questions about Murphy Brown.
Because that's fucking dumb.
Yeah.
1992 was a wild ass year. I'm going to talk a little bit about this in my story in a couple weeks. But, like, things were blowing up, and you're talking about what?
Nothing. You're talking about a woman who doesn't exist. Wow. That's what you want to talk about.
Yeah.
It's so absurd. So, the next day, the New York Daily News ran a headline that said, "Quail to Murphy Brown, you tramp." All caps, exclamation point.
That was a play on the Ford to New York drop dead.
Oh, yeah.
Which is also that was the Post.
The Post.
Yeah.
Yeah. I thought it sounded a little familiar. Yeah. Yeah. For people who aren't in New York, the New York Post and the New York Daily News, they're in like an unofficial competition with each other to just be, to see who has the most like ain't shit headline. And it's always very close because they're both doing the worst.
Yeah.
So Diane English, she is the show's creator. She issued a brief that read, "If the vice president thinks it's disgraceful for an unmarried woman to bear a child, and if he believes that a woman cannot adequately raise a child without a father, then he'd better make sure abortion remains safe and legal."
Excuse me. Yeah.
Right? It later came out that Dan Quayle had never even seen the fucking show.
Are you fucking kidding me?
He had just heard about it because the show was always making fun of him.
He's just salty.
Yes. Diane English, who again is the show creator, she said, "We had done a Dan Quayle joke every episode. It was a mandate in our writer's room. The Dan Quayle joke in the birth episode had to be cut for time."
Amazing. Amazing.
So it's very possible, I mean, I think probable, that he just included this because his feelings were hurt.
Yeah, he was feeling sad.
Yeah.
Feeling butthurt about being made fun of. And was totally. Like, well, I'm going to tell you on a national stage. Mm-hmm.
So sensitive. And yet we're the emotional ones. Okay, exactly. Go off. Okay, girl. So the White House, they tried a variety of responses. Like, everyone involved in this press release should be fired. So at first, they said that they praised Quayle for his stance against what they called the glorification of single motherhood.
Oh my God.
Then when people are like, "Da fuck," he praised the show for its pro-life values, completely ignoring the fact, because they had a whole episode where Murphy Brown decides she's not going to get an abortion, but that was her choice. Like, if it wasn't legal, it's not pro-life. She's pro-choice. She made the choice.
Was considering an abortion and decided against it.
This like debate back and forth, it raged all summer with Quayle delivering all these speeches, extolling family values and like how we need to return to this American family and that anything that deviates from that is the reason why we're in the state that we're in. Trash. I mean, he's on the campaign trail, so he's always has a stupid mic in front of his face, and he is just going off.
Wow.
So there were rumors about the Murphy Brown season premiere, like for season 5. Like, people were dropping hints that, like, okay, this is going to be...
It's on.
It's on, basically. Yeah. Dan is going to be really sad very soon. So all eyes were on Candace Bergen, who is the actress who played Murphy Brown in August when she won an Emmy for Outstanding Lead in a Comedy Series.
Oh, that one burned his ass, I'm sure.
You know it did. I'm just picturing him as that emoji with the moist eyes. Uh-huh. Like,
oh my God.
So she starts her speech. She says, "I'd like to thank the vice president." And she just pauses for the laughter and the crowd goes wild.
Oh my God, I love it.
Oh my God. And she closes by thanking the writers for not all this is so petty. She said, she's thanking the writers for not only writing these great words, but spelling them correctly. So y'all remember this. I remember this shit happening. Dan Quayle was in New Jersey and he made a little Puerto Rican boy spell potato wrong. Like, he made him spell a potato with an E in front of a room full of students, in front of teachers, in front of the Secret Service and his God. Like, he just embarrassed. Oh my God. So good. So that happened over the summer and she's just digging it in.
I love it.
So good.
Love to see it.
This was a whole thing that was stupid. But do you know his defense?
No.
For why he made the child spell it wrong? Because it was on the card spelled wrong.
Oh, what? Yeah.
Sir, you're an adult. The 12-year-old boy knew how to spell it. And the fact that it's written on a card, like, you don't know that it's not spelled. Like,
he was set up. I don't know how to spell potato. I've been set up.
Again, this man went to law school, and this is his defense. Trash. Like, the most upsetting thing to me is, like, this law school, that it was totally wasted on him, you know?
Absolutely.
Totally wasted on him.
This man who doesn't know how to spell potato. So, oh, my Lord.
So Quayle, he responded the next day at a campaign rally, because, again, he's just always talking, always just embarrassing himself and his ancestors. He vented that he was sick of being a punchline to the cultural elites.
Then don't bring them into this.
Thank you.
You started this, motherfucker. Well, he didn't start
it. He didn't start it, but
he escalated it.
Yeah. Murphy Brown is fictional.
Like,
you're fighting with a fake woman.
Yeah.
Like, girl, no one told you to do this. So he said that last night they said I attack single mothers. That's a lie. Winning an Emmy is not a license to lie.
Shut.
I'm like, was he crying when he said this?
Sad. Sad, pathetic.
Right?
What?
Okay, go off, girl. Like, oh, what? It's not a license to lie. Okay, sir, come on.
Wow.
So the premiere came out, and the show uses his own words to make it seem like they're having a dialogue.
Okay.
In this fictionalized universe. And at the end of the episode, she responded by dumping a truckload of potatoes in his lawn.
Shut up.
And the episode is called You Say Potato with an E, I Say Potato, like spelled correctly.
Oh my God.
So 70 million viewers tuned in for that episode. And it was about 31 million more than voted for Bush Quayle.
I was just about to say, you're starting
later,
a war with a fictional character who is more popular than you are.
Yes. 6 weeks later, they lose the re-election.
Oh my God. Literally changed the course of history.
Yep, because your feelings were hurt. So the Dan Quayle moment made Murphy Brown like just a symbol of 90s feminism. After this happened, the show tackled a lot of issues. They tackled single motherhood, medical marijuana, and breast cancer. And every time, because Quayle gave her this platform, this made her character real in a way. Like,
totally.
Every single episode that tackled something that was really big became national conversation.
I was just going to say, he made the show way bigger than it probably was before.
Absolutely. Way bigger than it was before. Wow. It was big, but he made it huge.
Unbelievable.
So by the fifth season, Murphy Brown was the most expensive show to run ads on because it was the most popular show. And Bergen remains the only actress to have won an Emmy for playing the same character 5 times.
Wow.
So yeah, the end.
Amazing.
I just have a little side note about Dan Quayle, because when I told Jason that I was doing this story, he told me, like, oh, like, you know, he's in the news again. I'm just like, what? It turns out that Mike Pence reached out to Dan Quayle around the time of the insurrection, like before that. So he reached out to Quayle for like counsel because they're both from Indiana.
Okay.
So when Pence was getting the squeeze from Bush, oh my God, from Trump to steal the election, mm-hmm. he reached out and asked what
like how would
he
you
should
handle
do.
This? Yeah.
Yeah. I found this article from CNN. The title reads, "How Dan Quayle Saved Democracy." Yes, really. So the article references a back and forth between Pence and Quayle. So this is a quote from Quayle. He says, "Mike, you have no flexibility on this. None, zero, forget it, put it away." Because,
facts.
Yeah,
facts.
You can't just overthrow what the country has told you to do. Pence pressed him again, and he said, "You don't know the position I'm in." Because he's, you know, he's getting the squeeze from
sure,
Trump.
Of course.
And he says, "I know the position you're in. I also know what the law is. You listen to the parliamentarian. That's all you do. You have no power."
Absolutely. It's not a question.
Yeah.
I like, absolutely, he does understand the position you're in, but that doesn't change
yeah.
what your duty is. And
it's crazy that he was even considering it.
I know. Well, it's like, not knowing Trump. It's not. I'm not surprised
yeah,
by it.
Yeah, this is scary.
It's terrifying.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
So the author of this piece, he wrote, "If you think I'm exaggerating about the role Quayle played, consider how things might have gone if he had taken a different tack with Pence, telling him to do what Trump asked."
Yeah.
I'm just like, you're right.
Wow.
So I guess we got to thank Dan Quayle for doing this one good thing, you know?
Uh-huh.
He's still a piece of shit who's like really thin skin and frail. And also, he took a spot from a black person, so fuck you forever. But he did this good thing because it's true. Had he told him, like, yeah, do it.
Yeah, absolutely. What a loser. I did not know that story. You
oh,
were certain
I thought,
that I was.
Yeah, I thought you would know it. No, that's why I'm just like, this is going to be fun for both of us.
Never heard of it.
Wow. I mean, again, Murphy Brown isn't real, but I kind of vaguely remember a little something
yeah.
like this.
I know of Murphy Brown.
Yeah.
I know what the show is about, and I know that she was like sort of like a liberal like favorite.
I was watching CNN at a younger age than you.
And yeah, I was watching Married with Children.
Yeah, okay. I was watching like Desert Storm coverage with Wolf Blitzer in the 90s.
Nope.
So I do remember seeing her on CNN and being like, oh, okay, that's the woman from like that, you know, show on CBS.
Yeah. I know more of her work on Sex and the City.
Yeah. If only the beef was against like designing women.
Oh my God. Then yeah. I would be very, I would know every, and I would be telling this story.
Yeah, you would, you're right. You'd be telling this story.
If he had said ill words against
Delta.
Dixie Carter. Yeah. Dixie Carter was the real like feminist character in that show.
I never seen that.
It's Delta Works. Delta Work.
I love that. That's a drag queen,
drag
correct?
Queen, yes. Delta Burke's sister on Designing Women is the actress's name is Dixie Carter.
I just love the outfits.
Yes. Okay. I guess we need to stop talking about Designing Women. Thank you for that story. That was a wild ride.
Right?
You also really, I know that you did not know you were doing this,
what?
But you really
did I
nicely
set
me
stage?
Up. Yes.
Really?
For it has nothing to do with Dan Quayle or Candace Bergen or any of that, but I will
nothing should have to do with Dan Quayle.
Yeah, absolutely. But I will be sort of talking about very similar issues, very related
okay.
sort of issues going
mess.
Into my story in 2 weeks. So
cool.
Yeah.
Looking forward to it.
Our drinks are empty.
Yeah.
I got this little celery. I'm going to crunch into it.
I finished my celery.
It's so good. Mm. America's history is juicy. We just add tomato juice and vodka and a bunch of other spicy spices.
Yes, Old Bay.
It's the real thing. Thank you guys for listening to Beyond Reproach. This has been Tuxalurzel.
Stephanie Domingo.
Thank you to Tim Clough, our editor, sound engineer, and podfather. We could not do this without him.
Bye, guys.
Bye. Beyond Reproach is proudly recorded in Bushwick, Brooklyn, on land belonging to the Lenape Nation. Please note that we are not historians, we're just a couple of drunks who never shut up and love history. A full list of all source information can be found in the show notes on our website. Please take a moment to rate, review, and subscribe. And remember that written reviews are especially important. If you like us, please do one of two things. Leave us a review on Apple Podcasts, or send this episode to a friend, family member, or someone who you think would be into it. Don't forget to follow us on social media and make sure you follow us on Instagram because we post our cocktail recipes the Thursday before each full episode. Please drink along with us if you are not driving. We also have a shop at beyondreproachpod.com. Get your merch, brand yourselves, and we have exclusive content on Patreon where you can directly support the production of our show.